I recently described a day here to a friend as being chaotic. She asked me, what does a chaotic day look like in South Sudan, a land where one has such low expectations at times for order and stability, a land that can still surprise you with the speed at which it descends into disorder and muddle? I'm hunting through an old filing cabinet. It reminds me of one from my childhood, in which my father used to store important documents, bills, reports, deeds, in the days before everything in our lives could be contained on a card smaller than a thumbnail. There's clutter in here, old oxygen masks, discarded wires, a few vials of medicine. But this cupboard is actually my best hope of saving a life right now, because next door to me, in the room that the nurses use to prepare medicines, where we store notes, where the sickest children are also laid up hoping for a miracle, is a woman gasping for breath in the advanced stages of a life-threatening asthma attack. I came onto the ward to do some teaching with keen young trainees, but spotted her in the waiting area. This is a land so accustomed to problems that no one seems to expect you to intervene, or certainly not demand it. And for a moment I wonder if someone else might take care of this problem. But then I remind myself where I am and who I am. I'm a healthcare professional here, and as such, the thin line between chaos and order. It's 7 o'clock later that evening, and still there is a thick crowd of people around the ward, despite the end of visiting times 2 hours earlier. People are milling about in and around the ward. There's an air of the carnival almost, people sitting on blankets, eating, amiable, communal. In another setting, it'd be idyllic, but this is a hospital. And for the children now seemingly residing here, healthy, next to a sick sibling because their mother has no one at home to help with childcare, at least one will probably get diarrhea or malaria. A hospital functioning as a place to trade illnesses. Bring in diarrhea and get 2 cases of malaria. The guards have totally abandoned their posts, both at the main gate and the ward gate, and people are flooding in and out. I try to make a stand. I find the guard and together we slowly start to reinforce the gate, separating the healthy and the sick, bringing a little order. Young men in particular resist passively, sullen faces, wordless expressions. They're here for the night, unbudging, though I can't fathom their motive. I rarely see them with the children that presumably belong to them. Young men brood, linger after dark, wherever there is life. We're easily threatened, we who have so much to lose, by those who perhaps have never known prosperity or peace. Here in this place, everything melts, it seems, evaporates, blurs together. You put up a wall to keep the hospital secure, but people find a way around it. Guards are persuaded somehow, maybe threatened, maybe friends to those arriving, but the membrane is thin here and often permeable. It's the same with rules, with systems, with everything. Everything blends together. I find my clothes becoming scruffier, dirtier, threadbare. The red dust of the road staining my shoes, myself blending into the soil. Possessions get lost, all momentum fades, and eventually you live day to day, the energy and resources to change the place dissipating. Good intentions waste, ideas blur together, projects coalesce and muddle. I'm on a ward round earlier in the day. It's been a bank holiday weekend, and I'm trying to discharge as many patients as I can, the ward heaving at the seams, 60 children under the age of 3. I'm hoping that the 2 days since they've been seen will be sufficient, and in most cases it is. But one case troubles me, as it has done every day for the previous 3 days. It's a 3-month-old child with hydrocephalus, water on the brain. For some reason, likely an anomaly from the womb, the child cannot process the fluid that bathes the brain and it collects, causing the brain to expand. In the West, this is treated promptly and effectively, though the operation is expensive and follow-up prolonged. But here, the woman has no options and has simply sat in the bush, watching the child's head grow and conversely the body shrink. By the time the child arrives at our hospital, the head is the same size or perhaps greater than the body, and the child is unrecognisably human. I'm ashamed to admit that when I first saw the patient, I recoiled and could barely bring myself to examine her. She has such an alien form that I don't even know if I'll identify the anatomy correctly. The heart must be the size of a golf ball somewhere in her chest. Nothing has been done. Nature has taken its course and will take its course, because I'm sure this child will not pass a year. There can be no treatment now, no intervention, just a withering away of a life to nothing. I notice how natural and unaffected the mother appears. She picks the baby up by the head to feed her. She laughs at a joke made by the nurse on the round. But she seems at ease, caring, loving, like any mother. Apparently, I'm told, in one of the tribes in this country, children like this are left in the jungle to die. I don't quite get the humour here. Yet, being British, I'm meant to be the funny, sardonic one. I'm back in the filing cabinet, and to my amazement, I spot a drug that might just save the asthmatic woman's life. You see, it's a fourth-line treatment in the West, but here, options 1, 2, and 3 are not available this evening. The nebulizer that is used in the West is missing a key part, and she can't take an inhaler, so out of breath is she. Imagine spending 12 hours gasping for breath like you're running a 5K. I see the expiry date on the drug, 5 months ago. South Sudan feels like the 1950s mostly, so 2017 is a long way in the future. I draw up the drug because the nurses are elsewhere and administer it, sitting on an old blue garden chair next to a sink that isn't working, by our high dependency bed, which has 2 children on it, one of whom will die later that night. The woman slowly improves, and within half an hour, her breathing is settling. The matron finds the missing part of the nebulizer. It was outside, on the ground. You can't make it up. The part of the machine, whose absence might have cost a life, was in the dirt, outside, like a crisp wrapper or empty packet of cigarettes. I wonder how that conversation would play out in the West. Explain to someone that their relative died because the missing part of the nebulizer was on the ground outside for no obvious reason. 2 days later, the woman thanks me profusely. It took me 5 seconds to realize who she was, no longer prone and desperate on a bed. The following morning, I'm approached by a young father. Last night, we admitted his twin boys, 3 months old. They had been to 2 other hospitals in the 6 days before, been treated for malaria, even though tests suggested they didn't have malaria. In those 6 days, pneumonia took hold of one of them, gastroenteritis both of them, and as we admit them, it's clear to my eye that one will not make it through the night. I was wrong. That child sadly did not make it to the night. The father approaches me. I wonder how to say sorry to him for his loss. I cannulated the baby myself and had felt a little flush of success at being the only one able to. The ridiculous pride one still must take in this place at achieving something. And I wrote up medications knowing them to be in vain. But he quickly reaches the issue. No chance, thankfully, for me to blunder around with an apology. He wants to fly his wife and 2 sons, one dead, one living, back to Uganda, where they are from, for a proper funeral. He wants to know if it's safe to fly his other son. He wants to know if there's a way of preserving the other body. I explain that I've no experience in preserving bodies once dead. I start to wonder if I have much experience in preserving bodies that are still alive at times. Do I let them fly? This is for them their way out of chaos, their way of preserving the meaning of life and death, the upholding of ritual and belief. I think briefly about getting them to sign a waiver of liability, and then I decide to just let them go, with a promise to see a doctor there immediately, a promise I cannot make them uphold. I know it's a bad idea medically, but somehow it seems the right thing to do. I stand at the gates watching people watch me through the chain links. I'm a tall white guy, stopping them delivering food to their relatives. The cultural significance of this scene does not escape me. What's the greater ill? A white man from a country which built half this place in the name of progress, denying people what they feel is their natural right, to see their loved ones in their time of weakness. Or the possibility of a cholera epidemic, wiping out 1,000 lives in a heartbeat. I try to organise a proper means of funding treatment for a young diabetic patient that will guarantee her and her mother peace of mind for at least 5 years. At the moment, she and her mother are living on the edge, precariously, depending on me and the hospital for the bare minimum of medical supplies to keep her body working. I recoil at the appearance of a child that nature has created with a freak misformation in the womb, a tiny misformation, a tiny life that barely registers on the Richter scale. No crowdfunding or public campaigns out here. Life is taken so cheaply. We admit sick children and treat them next to the previous admission who's dying 2 feet away. Outside, there are dozens of people, some waiting to be seen, some seen but unhappy, some seemingly just enjoying our work. Two women stare through the meshed window like it's a television program. I hunt through an old filing cabinet because a piece of plastic has been dropped in the dirt outside. A woman might die because someone carelessly dropped something. This is what chaos looks like. You stand with one foot in order and one in the abyss and decide who to let pass because you can't save them all. You watch as some people fall into the abyss. You catch others. You go back to your room at the end of the day, hide behind a mosquito net, which is frequently breached anyway. You try to find time to concentrate on something which isn't broken. My laptop crashes that evening, as if to make a point. And chaos suddenly makes sense. In my world, everything has boundaries, separation, and context. I itemize, I separate, I focus. I compartmentalize in my head so I can do 10 tasks in a day well. But here, everything is blurred and mixed together. Visiting times, ward rounds, drug rounds, you start to think you imagine their existence. The jungle knows no separation, no itemization, and the people seem to grow, to spread, to retreat, to reclaim, to abandon in the same way. The wall around the hospital has gaps. The staff roster has gaps. Every machine will likely break within 12 months. Things go missing, things are found, sometimes broken, but life goes on. The woman with the malformed baby smiles at me when I pass her in the hospital. Her child seems happy. I'm more troubled than she is. She just seems to laugh like everyone else. They're laughing at absurdity, I tell myself. The asthmatic lady leaves the hospital with an inhaler she struggles to use, despite my best attempt to teach her how. Next time she might die because the doctor's not there to hunt in an old filing cabinet. People drift in and out of hospital, in and out of the jungle, in and out of health. The boundaries blur, but life goes on. And people keep smiling, laughing, joking. Through all this, I feel strangely happy here at the end of the day. Content, fulfilled, satisfied. A day sometimes feels like a day in which you've been ill, but finished in good health and grateful for it. I sleep well, I eat well, I run well. I greet children every morning and evening. Not a single person has offered me a harsh word here. No threat, no aggression, no hostility. Nothing but gratitude and praise. I feel embarrassed for it, but I rejoice in the human warmth of Anzara, South Sudan. But I'm troubled here, not at peace, because I know this parable is not one of joy and suffering, happiness and poverty. Death and illness are cruel beasts lurking in the jungle, taking away a child a day from our hospital, lives mourned with the same intensity and bereftness as anywhere in the world. When you've heard a mother confronting her dead child, you've heard everything. Walls, walls, and more walls. Some days it seems as if our lives in the West are nothing but a concentric network of walls and barriers dividing us, separating us. Here, you build a wall and it crumbles in months, and people pass back and forth across divides on paper. Boundaries, rules, and systems unreal and inexplicable. But there's one gate that you pass and never return from. And whoever you are, wherever you are, death is tragic. I watch a young mum sobbing because her child can't breathe. The staff are hunting for both medication and oxygen tubing. 20% of children die before they are 5 in South Sudan. They pass through life and are forgotten. The pain of each loss is real. Each mother standing at the gate when their child passes out of sight.